Hi, friends. Well, I'm glad to see you. I hope you're doing well. Thrilled you came to church. And for those of you joining us online, we're thrilled you joined us as well. Today, we return to a series that we've been calling Get a Life. This summer, we've worked through Colossians 3, 1 through 17, where God's people are called to get a new life, a life of peace and patience, a life of compassion and kindness, a life that's free of shame and overflowing with grace. And each week of the series, we're looking at a different aspect of the life that's truly life. And we have 3 weeks left in this series. Today brings us to verse 16, where the Apostle Paul writes, "Let the message of Christ dwell among you richly as you teach and admonish one another with all wisdom through psalms, hymns, and songs from the Spirit, singing to God with gratitude in your hearts." I find this verse fascinating. It hands us essential wisdom as apprentices of Jesus. But friends, the insight it offers is often disregarded and discounted by churchgoers today. This morning, we're going to look at the first half of this passage, and we'll look at the verse as a whole next week. Before we return to Colossians chapter 3, let's pray together. Lord, we invite you to speak. Even if what you have to say is hard to hear, even if what you have to say makes us squirm, Lord, may you make this a moment in which we are unusually self-aware and unusually honest with ourselves about our attitudes and actions. Make this a safe place to do that. Lord, make this a moment in which we're less concerned about the faults and flaws of others and more concerned about who you've called us to be. That is our prayer, and we pray it in the name of King Jesus. Amen. One morning, earlier this summer, Jackie Flournoy of Luthersville, Georgia, walked out her front door and exclaimed in astonishment, "What in the world is that?" A 5-foot stalk appeared seemingly overnight, springing from a plant in her front yard. The plant, an agave americana, is a succulent that was given to her by her daughter 36 years ago. It's commonly called a century plant, though its lifespan is usually between 10 and 30 years. The agave americana is known to suddenly sprout an imposing stalk near the end of its life, after which it blooms with radiant yellow blossoms. The stalk of Jackie's plant swiftly rose to a towering 25 feet. Her neighbors have come to refer to her as Jackie and the Beanstalk. And her story has been viewed on YouTube by over 2.5 million people. Now, her plant will die later this year, leaving behind buds that can take root and become new plants. But let me underscore this fact. The plant's greatest growth occurred in the last year of its life. Here's the key takeaway. We are without excuse. You really can teach an old dog new tricks. You're never too old to grow. For that matter, you're never too young either. Friends, I believe you can grow better and faster in your last years than any of your previous decades. Though I'd say to our young people, get going now. Some say people never change. I think I know what they mean when they say that. And I know some people never change. But I completely disagree with the declaration that people never change. You see, a long time ago, I got into the people change business. And I've seen countless people change for the better and for the worse. But here's the point I hope sinks deep into your soul today. If you're breathing, then you're not beyond learning. If you want to learn. Now, not all of us want to learn. Not all of us want to procure the ingredients necessary for a life that grows. I would argue that followers of Jesus, when they're really following Jesus, live in a constant posture of learning. Think about it. A disciple is a student, an apprentice. As apprentices of Jesus, we are learning from Jesus how to live. And friends, we don't graduate from disciple to master in this life. We're continually learning from him. That's what the Apostle Paul's getting at when he writes to his friends, "Let the message of Christ dwell among you richly." Paul is longing for the teaching of Jesus, the teaching about who he is and what he's done, the teaching about who we are and how we're called to live. Paul longs for that teaching of Jesus to take up residence in our souls, both individually and collectively. That word richly can be translated abundantly. It emphasizes Paul's hope that the teaching of King Jesus would become so pervasive that it permeates every one of our conversations, every one of our thoughts, every one of our feelings. Now, those of you who have studied the teaching of Jesus know, if that happens in your life, you will experience abundant life, the life promised by the King. But friends, for that to happen, we will need to be open to the teaching and admonition of other people who are learning from Jesus too. Now, in Paul's passage, that word teach has mostly positive connotations. It's the conveyance of information. But that word admonish is mostly negative. That means warn, rebuke, correct. Friends, here's what this means. If you don't have people in your life who love God and love you, that hold you accountable and offer you correction, then you have greatly diminished the chances that the teaching of Jesus will truly take root in your life. And that means you'll miss out on the life that's truly life, which Paul's been talking about. So here's the truth. Here's the truth I hope you embrace today. If you want to live, you got to listen. You've got to become open to the feedback presented to you by the people that God put in your life. Now, next week, we're going to pick up on the second half of the verse to talk about the surprising role the songs we sing in church play in our shared journey of faith. But this week, I want to simply begin with this question. You have a truth teller in your life? I'm talking about someone who's not afraid to tell you when they think you're wrong. Someone who can speak truth to you about your attitudes and actions. Well, if you're not sure, you probably don't. Proverbs 19, verse 20. Listen to advice and accept discipline. And at the end, you'll be counted among the wise. The book of Proverbs tells us the wisest men and women listen and learn in order to become wiser. And friends, they aren't merely looking for tips or tweaks. They're searching for discipline. That word discipline in the text is the Hebrew word musar. Musar means instruction or teaching, but it's teaching in the context of correction. And the wise treat that correction like treasure. Throughout Proverbs, wisdom is personified as a woman. In Proverbs 8, verse 10, woman wisdom says, "Choose my instruction instead of silver, knowledge rather than choice gold." That word instruction, musar, implies correction. And woman wisdom says that's better than riches. Proverbs 6, verse 23, "For this command is a lamp, this teaching is a light, and correction and instruction are the way to life." Now, in this verse, we find that word alongside a synonym. Instruction here translates the word musar. Correction translates the word tochachat. Say that with me. Tochachat. Now, I found it's easier to say tochachat than receive tochachat. The word is often translated rebuke or reprimand. Well, as hard as it may be to hear, Proverbs says It's the way to life. But Proverbs 4 goes even further. Verse 13, hold onto instruction. Do not let it go. Guard it well, for it is your life. Again, this isn't referring to the gentle guidance of a tutor. Musar is discipline and correction. Friends, the sages who God inspired to write the book of Proverbs believed if you want to live, you got to listen. You got to get open to the feedback of others. Proverbs 15:31 contends, whoever heeds life-giving correction will be at home among the wise. Wisdom, in the book of Proverbs, has little to do with talent or training or intellect, as important as those traits may be. You know, you can be talented without being teachable. Wise people are teachable. Wise people never stop learning because they know life will never stop teaching. A telltale sign of the wise is they know they don't have everything figured out. Only a fool thinks he has all the answers. Only a fool thinks she's perfect and above correction. According to Proverbs, wise people cherish feedback. But friends, whatever you do, don't make the mistake of assuming you're a teachable person. You may, in fact, be teachable in many areas of life, but resistant to feedback in others. How willing are you to see how you're contributing to the communication problem in your marriage or the organizational problem at work? How willing are you to see how you've enabled your child's behavioral problem? Proverbs 25, verse 12, like an earring of gold or an ornament of fine gold is a wise man's rebuke to a listening ear. Wise people cherish feedback. Often we resist feedback because of a subconscious fear of looking dumb or feeling unwise. But friends, this is essential. Wise people are more concerned about being wise than looking wise. And wise people are more concerned about being wise than feeling wise. They aren't obsessed with perception management. They're more concerned about reality. Proverbs 12, verse 1, whoever loves discipline loves knowledge. But whoever hates correction is stupid. Stupid translates a Hebrew word, ba'ar. It refers to someone who lacks the ability to reason like a human. See, the person who hates correction has the rationale of a beast. Of course, nobody likes to hear something bad about themselves. Nobody likes to have their flaws brought into the light. It is humbling, sometimes humiliating. The truth often hurts. But my friends, if it is true that I have a problem with anger or arrogance or alcohol and I love the people around me, then I need to hear that truth. If there's a particular talent or skill that I lack at work and a coworker or colleague brings it to my attention, it would be absolutely illogical, irrational, dare I say, stupid, to shove it under the rug and pretend it's not true. Especially if I care about the organization, or the relationship, or my soul. According to the book of Proverbs, wise people love truth, even when the truth is difficult to hear. See, they've learned, if they want to truly live, they got to really listen. You know what a rumble strip is? Sometimes they're called sleeper lines or growlers. And they offer my favorite analogy for this topic. I shared it with some of you several years ago. A rumble strip is that groove or raised marker placed on a roadway to get a driver's attention, maybe to warn the driver to slow down or alert the driver that they've drifted out of their lane. When the wheels of a vehicle come into contact with the rumble strip, the driver and everyone else in the car hear an irritating rumble and feel a jarring vibration. I hate rumble strips. So does my family. We just got back from a road trip. If we're on a road trip and I roll over a rumble strip, from the back of the vehicle I hear, Dad! And it's not just the sound that's so irksome. It's the grating feeling of vibration. When you drive onto a rumble strip, you immediately want to drive off a rumble strip. I don't like rumble strips. But I need rumble strips on the road. And I need rumble strips in my life. See, a rumble strip is an intentionally placed warning sign designed to get my attention. I need them for my driving decisions. I need them for my diet decisions. I need them for decisions I make in both my personal life and my professional life. Now, friends, there are countless ways that we can build metaphorical rumble strips into our lives. We have smartwatches and smartphones that help us manage our physical health and our financial health, even our spiritual health. But you know, I have found the best rumble strips are human. I need to surround myself with people who can serve as warning indicators, people who can speak into my life, people who can shout into my life if necessary. I need people on the journey with me who can alert me to impending danger like a rumble strip. When they see me veer too far out of my lane, no, nobody likes the feeling of unexpectedly running over a rumble strip, but a rumble strip might be the difference between you and a ditch or you and oncoming traffic. You gotta install a few rumble strips in your life. Now, I'll illustrate this principle with a story from the life of King David. As some of you know, David traveled a tumultuous journey from the pastures of Bethlehem to the palace in Jerusalem. He was the man after God's own heart who wrote many of the Psalms in the Bible. But did you know, David didn't finish well. According to the narrator of 1 and 2 Samuel, David's leadership ends in disaster. We don't get a lot of details about his decisions toward the end of his rule, but what is clear is that somewhere along the way, David stopped listening. If David built rumble strips into his life or his administration, he isn't paying attention to them by the end of 2 Samuel. See, somewhere along the way, David forgot that if you want to live, you got to listen. And the price he pays is steep. Now, here's what David does wrong in 2 Samuel 24. Brace yourself for this. He takes a census. Now, the story of King David has confused many readers over the centuries. I mean, what's the big deal about a census? Well, I'll do my best to explain. To be sure, counting people is not a sin, okay? In fact, in the book of Numbers, God commands his people to take a census four times. Counting isn't evil. Math isn't evil, in spite of what your kids say. No, the census is not the problem, but the census is the problem. As the chapter unfolds, we discover David's desire to take a census enrages the Lord. And as best we can figure, here's why. The desire for a census reveals a shift in David's faith. In the ancient world, a census was typically undertaken to assess taxes or to assess the strength of the military. Now, the details of 2 Samuel 24 reveal David's purpose is likely the latter. The census here reflects David's change of thinking from the battle is the Lord's to the battle is mine. In the past, David put his faith in God for protection and provision. Now, David's acting just like any other king in the ancient Near East. His motives may be pride. Look at how strong I am. His motive may be ambition. How many nations might I conquer? But no matter the motive, David's actions reveal a misplaced trust. Ironically, David had the proper perspective in an earlier season of life. Psalm 20, verse 7, some trust in chariots and some in horses, but we trust in the name of the Lord our God. See, the census of 2 Samuel 24 says this backwards. It seems that David, as he got older, put his faith in chariots and horses, in spite of his earlier declaration. David's arrogance and self-sufficiency enrages God, who'd given him so much and proven himself to David so many times. Now, you may defend David because it doesn't seem like a big deal. But in the context of 2 Samuel, it was a big deal, and David should have known better. Here's David's bright idea in the context. Verse 2. So the king said to Joab and the army commanders with him, "Go throughout the tribes of Israel from Dan to Beersheba and enroll the fighting men so that I may know how many there are." But Joab replied to the king, "May the Lord your God multiply the troops 100 times over, and may the eyes of my lord the king see it. But why does my lord the king want to do such a thing?" Now, if you've read David's story, you may remember Joab. Joab is no saint. Joab is not known for his sensitivity to the things of God. But in this moment, Joab sees danger, and he questions the king. Oh, he's subtle about it, but that's probably because he's learned his king doesn't like confrontation. Now, if you paid close attention, you may have heard something subtly embedded in Joab's words. Let me read it again, and we'll see if you hear it too. Verse 3, Joab replied to the king, "May the Lord your God multiply the troops 100 times over, and may the eyes of my lord the king see it. But why does my lord the king want to do such a thing?" Did you hear it? And Joab's intent is not lost on King David. Look at verse 4. The king's word, however, overruled Joab and the army commanders. So they left the presence of the king to enroll the fighting men of Israel. David ignores the advice of his most trusted advisor. Literally, it says, the king's word overpowered Joab. David barreled right over the rumble strip. As king, no one could question him. No one could call him on the carpet. He had no accountability. David, it seems, had developed a habit of not listening. Now, conversely, early in his life, David listened. David listened to Jonathan when he confronted him. David listened to Abigail when she confronted him. But the older and more powerful David became, the less he listened to the people around him. Remember later in life the story of David and Bathsheba? David sees the beautiful woman. David wants the beautiful woman. David asks his servant about the beautiful woman. His servant says, her name is Bathsheba, and she's somebody's wife. That's probably as clear as David's servant felt comfortable being without losing his head. As king, no one could question David. But in his mind, no one needed to question him. See, David got where he got in part because he listened. But once David got where he got, he stopped listening. That's often what happens when we become the boss, when we become the parent, when we become the elder. We stop listening because, we say, we have no reason to listen. But friends, young and old and everywhere in between, learn from the lesson of King David. If you want to live, you got to listen. And the wisest people don't sit around waiting for someone to speak up. Verse 15 of Proverbs 18. The heart of the discerning acquires knowledge. The ears of the wise seek it out. See, this proverb takes it to the next level. Wise people don't simply receive truth. Wise people don't simply love truth. Wise people search for it. And when they hear it, though it may be more painful than a root canal, they'd rather embrace the truth than live the lie. They've learned if they want to truly live, then they've got to really listen. Let's return to that old metaphor. Can you teach an old dog new tricks? Can you teach a pastor that he doesn't have it all figured out? You'd be surprised how hard that is. The wise chase and cherish instruction. They value feedback at work. They prize feedback on the golf course. They treasure feedback even in the most personal areas of life, health, money management, marriage. Friends, my problem is I don't always welcome correction. Instead of embracing the outlook of the wise, I cling to the reaction of the fool. Proverbs 12:15. The way of fools seems right to them, but the wise listen to advice. The book of Proverbs has much to say about foolish people. Their folly shows up as laziness and carelessness. It shows up as anger and adultery. But one of the primary characteristics of a fool is their inability to hear that they're acting foolish. The fool thinks they have it all figured out, so they don't seek the insight of others. Or if they do seek the counsel of confidants, they simply inquire of people who know, they'll tell them what they want to hear. And that's perfectly justified to the fool because the fool is convinced they're right. Beware. Beware. You may not think you need someone else's perspective on your life right now. You may think you know what's wrong with your marriage or why you weren't promoted at work. Oh, you say things with clarity from your angle. You got it all figured out. But my friend, what if your angle of observation is giving you a skewed view of reality? What if you think of yourself as a good listener, but the people closest to you think of you as a good interrupter? Well, what if you think you're even-tempered and patient, but the people that you work with experience you as edgy and easily annoyed? Well, what if your behavior is in your blind spot and you just can't see it? Well, there's one way to find out. You could ask somebody. That's what the wise do. The foolish do the opposite. Proverbs 15:12. Mockers resent correction, so they avoid the wise. Here the fool is one who mocks or attacks someone who gives them feedback. See, the posture is defensive. Yeah, well, you. They know the best way to avoid the experience of feedback is to avoid people who might give it. But when they do, they're only hurting themselves. Proverbs 15:32. Those who disregard discipline despise themselves. But the one who heeds correction gains understanding. Then the sages look at the topic of feedback from the opposite angle. Proverbs 23, verse 9. Do not speak to fools, for they will scorn your prudent words. See, this proverb describes the futility of confronting a fool. Hear me. They won't listen. They'll probably ignore you and probably ridicule you. Well, if you can't speak to a fool, what do you do with a fool? Well, that's another sermon for another service. But I will, however, recommend a book to you. It's called Necessary Endings by Henry Cloud. I referred to it earlier in this series. I told you I'd come back to it. And if you have someone in your life who has trouble hearing truth, whether a spouse or a friend or a coworker, chapter 7 of this book is written with you in mind. Don't misunderstand Dr. Cloud's intent from his title. If you're married to a person with foolish tendencies, he's not advocating a necessary ending to your marriage. He's handing you tools to bring about a necessary ending to their foolish behavior. And I got to tell you, this book is one of the most important books I've ever read. In chapter 7, the whole book is incredible, but in chapter 7, Dr. Cloud identifies three types of people, or more accurately, three types of behavior that show up in all of us at one time or another. He writes about the wise, the foolish, and the evil. And he shows you how you need to deal with each person or behavior differently. You see, you could talk to a wise person. You can confront or correct a woman of wisdom because she'll listen. She'll thank you for the feedback. She's an open system. But if you confront a fool, you'll be wasting your words. If you keep talking, your words will become senseless nagging. Your words have no power. Instead, with the fool, you have to use loving limits and appropriate consequences. That's the only way to get through to them. Now, I won't elaborate more on that topic today. I will, however, tell you about my experience with Dr. Cloud's book. See, I first read the book in May 2011. I can take you right back to the time and the place. I was sitting at a Panera Bread Company in Riverside, California, drinking an unsweetened iced tea light on the ice. I remember it so well because it became one of the most important moments of my life, and I'm not exaggerating. Remember, Dr. Cloud writes this chapter with the assumption that his reader is a wise man or woman learning to deal with different types of people. But as I read Dr. Cloud's words that day, the Spirit of God gave me a glimpse into my soul, and I saw something true about myself. See, as Dr. Cloud described the tendencies of a fool, he was describing the tendencies of Troy. My eyes were thrown wide open. Dr. Cloud explains, if you confront a fool with a difficult truth, he tries to adjust the truth rather than adjust to the truth. If you confront a foolish friend, she'll get defensive. She'll deflect the confrontation. She'll blame someone else, often blaming you for the problem. If you confront a foolish person, he won't take ownership of the issue. He'll minimize, rationalize, justify his behavior to convince you and everyone else, it's not that bad. Everyone does it. Everyone does it. When corrected, the foolish man or woman is oblivious to how their problem hurts others. He might respond with anger. She might attack you. Shoving her issues aside to catalog your faults and flaws. Or he might see himself as the victim of your vicious assault. You always blame me. You point out all my mistakes. You never say anything nice about me. When I first read chapter 7 of Necessary Endings, Dr. Cloud didn't hand me tools to deal with foolish behavior. He gently exposed me for the fool that I am. And Cloud's observations come directly from the wisdom literature of the sages. Proverbs 9, verse 7. Whoever corrects a mocker invites insult. Whoever rebukes the wicked incurs abuse. My friend, when you receive negative feedback about yourself, when you're taught or admonished by someone in your life, do you instinctively shoot the messenger? Do you invalidate their rebuke by saying, yeah, but he's an idiot. She has no idea what she's talking about. How could she? She's a train wreck. See, if you confront a fool with a problem, it's never the fool's problem. It's always your problem or someone else's problem. Confront a fool and you'll get conflict and contradiction. Look at verse 8. Do not rebuke mockers or they will hate you. Cloud says, if you confront a foolish person, they will either move against you or move away from you. However, if you rebuke the wise, they will love you. More recently, Dr. Cloud wrote a different book on leadership. It's called Boundaries for Leaders, and it's a great book for business leaders. In it, he quotes Ken Blanchard, who says, feedback is the breakfast of champions. But Cloud remarks, well, Blanchard gets it exactly right about the kind of breakfast we need. The truth is that not everyone has the same appetite for breakfast. Some people wake up and really want it, while it makes others sick to their stomachs. Some are allergic to feedback. Here's why. The fool perceives feedback as a threat. Now, if you perceive something as a threat, you'll instinctively move to a fight or flight response. It actually triggers a biochemical reaction in the brain. You might fight the threat by dismissing it or debating it, or you might choose flight as you withdraw as the wounded victim. But the key here is you will only have a fight or flight response when there is perceived danger. Cloud writes, If we see feedback as dangerous, we will bristle and fight it. But if we perceive feedback as an unexpected windfall, like winning the lottery, we will seek it out and be open to it, and sometimes even pay for it. That is what good character does. It hungers for feedback. Proverbs 9, verse 9. Instruct the wise, and they will be wiser still. Teach the righteous, and they will add to their learning. Wise men and women find the courage to welcome correction because they see the value of correction. The foolish feel they need to end every conversation smelling rosier than their opponent. The foolish feel the need to win. The wise understand you'll win by becoming wiser. And sometimes that requires correction. Now, when someone confronts you, what's your initial response? Deflection? Defensiveness? Debate? Do you rationalize your behavior with excuses or accusation? Or do you see it as a glorious opportunity to grow? Here's the truth. You will be confronted by obnoxious people. You will be corrected by arrogant people. You'll get feedback from people who have absolutely no business giving you feedback. People whose feedback really isn't fair or factual. But hear me. The wise listen nonetheless. By that I don't mean you do what they say. Not always. Look, you can listen to people without listening to people, okay? Even if they're wrong, you can hear them out with patience and humility without getting defensive. That being said, many times I found priceless nuggets of truth in the words of belligerent and cantankerous people. Look, at minimum, being open to listening is an opportunity for you to flex your feedback muscle. It's an opportunity to practice humility. And we could all use a little practice now and then. Leadership coach James Vorkola wisely observes, great things happen whenever we stop seeing ourselves as God's gift to others and start seeing others as God's gift to us. Friends, in a world that never stops changing, we need leaders who never stop learning. We need moms who never stop listening. We need teachers who are taught and students who teach. There's an old expression, if you're not willing to learn, no one can help you. If you're determined to learn, no one can stop you. So let me ask you a question. From whom do you have trouble receiving feedback? Is it your spouse? Is it your mother? Is it people who aren't as talented as you? Think about that a second. Do you have trouble hearing negative feedback from people who aren't as successful as you? Well, if that's you, do you realize the world's highest performers gladly and regularly receive feedback every day from people who can't do what they do? People who don't have a prayer of doing what they do. You know who those high performers are? Athletes. And they receive feedback from coaches who can't do what they do. Now at Capital, we got a church full of coaches. I have to ask them. Maybe they used to be able to do what their athletes do, but often that isn't even true. And good athletes don't have a problem with that. And they're better athletes because they listen. From whom do you have trouble receiving feedback? Maybe you struggle responding wisely to feedback in your marriage. Oh, you don't mind if a friend calls you out on your attitude? Huh, but you don't handle it well when it's your spouse. When he comes to you with the problem, you throw it right back in his face, reminding him of his foibles and failures rather than receiving and growing. What about your kids? Can you model teachability to your children? Some parents feel we should never apologize to our child when we lose our patience or lose our temper. We think we need to put up a strong front, show no weakness. But when we do, I gotta wonder if all we're doing is modeling arrogance and teaching our kids that when they grow up, they won't need to take responsibility for their actions either. Or maybe for you, the problem isn't the person. Maybe the problem is your position. You're the boss. You got where you got because you're good. You got where you got because you're better than everyone else. Now, you'd never say that out loud, but that's how you feel. And I wonder if you show that in the way you receive feedback. Here's something I'm learning. There are some forms of coaching that can only come from the people who work for me. Look, I would love to be coached by Henry Cloud or some great leader in my field who's learned what I haven't learned yet. In the last month, I've had two conversations with two of my greatest heroes in life. Wonderful. But no kidding, I've learned my most important lessons from the people closest to me. And honestly, those people either work for me or are married to me, or both. One of the most widely respected church leaders today is a man named Andy Stanley. I've learned a lot from him about leadership, but one of the most important things I've learned is found in a simple confession that explains how he manages his team. Stanley says, "I'm not the smartest person in the room. I'm just the leader." Supervisors, CEOs, managers, coaches, don't miss out on the opportunity to be coached by someone who you're responsible to coach. They have an experience you'll never have because they know what it's like to work for you. They've experienced the wake of your sailboat. You haven't. They see the blind spots you can't see. And they see them from an angle that's unfamiliar to you, but true of you nonetheless. You see, the wisest leaders know. If you want to live, you got to listen. Now, to stay on leaders for a moment. If you're the leader, you probably have to give permission to your team to speak up and speak into your life and leadership. You'll have to do this constantly. I'm learning that I have to regularly say things like, no, push back. Poke holes in this. What am I missing? I say that stuff all the time. Ask our team. Now, if you think you don't need that feedback loop, beware of thinking too highly of yourself. And understand you may be making your organization or your family or your friends or your spouse miserable. You know what it's like to be on the other side of a leader or a spouse or a colleague who can't receive feedback? It's hopeless. Does that sound like hyperbole? Because it's shockingly accurate. That's because our inability to give and receive feedback well creates an atmosphere of organizational and relational hopelessness. If you feel stuck in any aspect of your job or personal interactions with the people of your life, ask yourself, could this really be a problem with giving and receiving feedback? Earlier I said, don't assume you're teachable. I mean that. You may be blind to your inability to receive feedback. You might say, surely, Troy, someone would have told me if that were true of me. Well, that's not necessarily the case. See, if you've struggled with receiving feedback for a long time, it's highly likely that the people around you have subconsciously learned not to give you feedback. You've trained them. They've learned it doesn't go well when they do. You just outflank them, you dismiss them, you out-debate them, you blow up or you shut down. It's a waste of their time. The chances are, my friend, you might be surrounded by hopeless, miserable people who can't articulate why they're so frustrated with you. That was true of me. When our Lord opened my eyes to my pride and my insecurity, I had to schedule some appointments with some important people, look them in the eye, and tell them how sorry I was. Is there anyone you need to go to in confession this week? Ask yourself honestly, Are you a person who's easy to approach with feedback? Have you given the people around you permission to speak into your life? Or have you given them the impression they can do no more than hint? Friends, what if we saw feedback as a gift? Not just a gift from the individual, but a gift from God. See, God wants to use the people around you, the people who report to you, the people who annoy you, to shape you into a person of character and competence as we teach and admonish one another. Will you allow him to do this work through them? Pray with me. Lord, in this moment, I pray you've used this message. I pray you've used these potent proverbs to get our attention. Because many of us have developed ingrained habits, patterns of being defensive. We defend, we deflect, we blame, we rationalize, we minimize. It's not my fault, it's your fault. How dare you, we say. And those responses have become so rote. Well, we consider them to be strengths. We're tough. May our eyes be open to see how very weak we've become. The strongest among us cherish feedback. The wisest among us chase it. Look, I know that moment for me. Back some 12 or 13 years ago. That moment for me is stamped on my heart as one of the most important moments of my life and my leadership. And that's impacted all of my relationships more than almost any other moment. I pray that you give the people in this room listening to this message, people who are viewing this online, a moment like that if they need it. May your spirit come in your gentle presence, your gentle, comforting presence with truth. Truth we desperately need to hear. Lord, give us the courage to welcome correction. Though the truth hurts, though it exposes our deepest insecurities, may we lean into that and trust you. The good news is we don't need to just trust a process. We can trust you because it's your message, your word, your teaching that can richly sink into our souls through the teaching and admonition of the people around us. Lord, show us the value of candor and accountability in our marriage and our friendships. And Lord, in this church, make it so. Help us to trust that it's all a part of your plan as we journey together, teaching and admonishing one another. And Lord, I pray for my friends who didn't know what to expect coming to church, visiting a church for the first time. This was not what they were expecting. But I pray their eyes are open to see the wisdom that comes from your teaching. Maybe they've been hurt by church people or church leaders like me who, I don't know how else to say this, but to be blunt, we're fools. And they got chewed up and spit out by a church of fools. Lord, may they especially sense your grace today. And may they recognize this day is another invitation to them to trust you. Show them they can. May they find the faith to put your words into practice. Lean in. See what happens. That's my prayer, and I pray it in the name of the King. Amen. Okay. I got some homework for you, okay? Here is a book. I've recommended this book to you before. I think it's been a number of years since I've done it, but I'm telling you, it's one of my favorites. It's called Thanks for the Feedback by Douglas Stone and Sheila Heen. I'll read to you the subtitle. you probably can't read it from a distance. It says, the science and art of receiving feedback well, even when it's off base, unfair, poorly delivered, and frankly, you're not in the mood. The authors are part of the Harvard Negotiation Project, and I'll tell you, this is a smart book. It's a fun book. It's really funny. But it's really good social science. It'll make you a better leader. But it's also such a potent book that it will make you a better disciple of Jesus. Hear me, this is not a Christian book. But we can recognize truth in places outside the Bible, and I'll tell you, this is a potent little book, the wisdom of which I prayed for years. The authors say, the reason we have so much trouble with feedback is we have these two competing needs. The first need is we have a need to learn and grow. Great. But we also have a need to be accepted, respected, and loved the way we are right now. We long for unconditional love. And those two needs clash on a daily basis, don't they? So where is our hope? Now, I'm going to take you somewhere you're not going to find in the Bible. Your hope is found in King Jesus. Let me tell you what I mean. This is how God is with us every single day. Think of the parable of the prodigal son. Okay, those of you who know it. This beautiful, potent image of this son who's run away from the father, squandered the father's wealth, just living la vida loca out there, and his life falls apart, and he hobbles back to the father, wanting to beg him to just simply be a slave, not his son. But before the son can get anywhere near the father races to his son with arms wide open, and he picks him up out of the muck and mire and brings him in for an embrace. That is our God. That is his unconditional love. Got it? And as he brings us in for the embrace, he whispers in our ear, I think we have a few things to work on. That's God. You can trust him. See, what does John 1:14 tell us? Jesus came to dwell among us full of grace and truth. You can trust him. Hear me, friends. If you're doing anything important, you got to read this book. If you're doing anything important, like raising kids or leading a department or saving your marriage or breathing, if you're breathing, drop everything and read this book, okay? It's good. It's good. You can get it on audio as well, okay? Let God use it. Let God use this book to see why feedback might be so challenging for you, okay? Now, second assignment. You ready? I want to encourage you to install a few rumble strips in your life, okay? Here's what I mean. Find two or three safe people and regularly give them, here, let me say that again, regularly give them permission to speak into your life so you can stay in your lane. Remember, a rumble strip alerts you to slow down or veer left. A rumble strip says, wake up. So what I'm saying is develop spiritual friendships with people who love God and love you, who can help you see where you need to grow. Look, Sheila Heen says, if you don't know what you need to work on, you know who does? Everybody else, okay? Everybody else. They're just afraid to tell you. So she says, ask him this question. These are her words. She says, what's one thing you see in, the one thing you see me doing or failing to do that you think I should change? Now notice, her question assumes there is something. Heen reminds us, if you ask, is there anything? They'll probably say no. If you assume there's something, they'll probably just pick something off their list, okay? So ask them, what can I do to change? What do you see? There's one more book, Necessary Endings. I recommended it earlier. And this is for those, if you have somebody in your life who you're struggling to give feedback to because they defend, deflect, blame, rationalize, minimize, all this stuff. Well, chapter 7, I mean, it's a brilliant book to begin with, but chapter 7 of this book is a real keeper, and I absolutely adore it. So It's not a year goes by that I don't give Henry Cloud a thank you note for his influence on my life, and I'm not kidding you. Ever since that day, I was just with him 2 weeks ago. Pick it up. May God use it in your life. Here's a verse for the week, Proverbs 4:13. I read it a few moments ago. Hold on to instruction. Do not let it go. Guard it well, for it's your life. Oh, friends, embrace it. The image on the screen and the graphic that follows will be available for you to download from our website, so be watching for them. Stand with me. Okay, before you go, I'm going to tell you about something that's coming up. You said worship night. I was going to say that, but the sermon was too long, so I'm not going to tell them that the worship night is next Sunday night. I don't know. I'm just the pastor. It's at 7 o'clock, but I'm not going to tell them that because I don't have time for that, Teresa. Okay, thanks. Check this church center app. Church center app. That's good. Thanks. I don't have time to tell him that, though. I'll tell him next week. Okay. In 3 weeks from today, we begin a series that we call God and the Movies. If you're new to our community, this is a series we do from time to time, which allows us to use some of Hollywood's stories to illustrate the story of God and his people. Each week we take a different movie and a different text from the Bible and we invite God to speak, okay? Now I'm telling you now, because I want to encourage you to bring a friend with you. Over the years, we found this series to be memorable and a memorable and meaningful way to share the message of King Jesus. I know several of you have attended Capital Church for the very first time during the movie series, and maybe your friend will be next. Will you bring him with you? Okay. Friends, if you came with a need, there will be people here at the front to pray for you. You're invited to do that. If you're viewing this online or even throughout the week, you're all welcome to send us an email, care@capitalchurch.com, because we love to pray over your needs. This is the prayer I want to leave with all of you today. My friends, may you develop the confidence in King Jesus and his teaching to chase and cherish feedback in every area of your life. Thanks for coming today. Grace and peace.